This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in to WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm excited about today's show, not only for the fact that it's an interesting topic, but because it's super interesting guests in hand. We have Barbara Norden. We have Hawes Spencer, two local journalists slash authors. Is authors an appropriate title for both of you?
Not for me.
Muckraker. I like muckraker.
I like just unemployed freelance journalist.
Unemployed freelance journalist. So it is for Hawes Spencer and Barbara Norden. But employed enough for each of you to have written an article on some recent news, of which we'll be talking about early in the hour. Today's show is on missing persons. And my goal today is to talk about three specific cases that are of a more historical sense than some of the others that may immediately come to mind. And one of them specifically, the case of missing person Patrick Collins, has had some new information. So sit back, get relaxed. One of those programs where you're like, oh, wow, I had no clue about that. And interesting tales to be woven by Hawes Spencer and Barbara Norden. So let's jump right in. Again, our guest, Barbara Norden, Hawes Spencer, local journalist slash muckraker, to talk about the case of Patrick Collins. Now, Barbara, your attachment to this case is long and deep.
Yes.
So talk a bit about Patrick Collins and this case.
I describe it as my consuming passion, and it has been for 17 years. I'm writing a book about it. Pat disappeared into thin air in 1986. He was a graduate student in physiology at UVA, and he left behind a very strange tableau in Jordan Hall on grounds where all his important stuff, like his backpack, wallet, keys, glasses, contacts, ID, driver's license, credit card, everything was there. And the rest of his stuff, his car and his bikes, were at his apartment in Belmont. So immediately Charlottesville in 1986 was just gripped by this kind of locked room mystery. What could have happened to this guy? And the UVA police was the agency involved. They behaved immediately as if he had voluntarily walked away from his life. His family in California was vehement that he wouldn't have and that he wouldn't have killed himself. Relations soured quickly between UVA and the family in California. They came out to investigate, and things just kind of went south from there. And I'm actually going to now turn it over and ask Hawes to just, he knows this story almost as well as I do. Why don't you kind of take the listeners on from after what happened in the years, like, you know, why did we start thinking that Pat had been murdered?
Well, Barbara, you set that stage beautifully, and your research really is going to come back to us today and answer most of the questions. But we really were operating under the sense that he was murdered. And I say we, and I speak of law enforcement professionals, retired law enforcement professionals, not just his friends and family who couldn't fathom the idea that he might have left on his own agency. And the UVA police behaved in a way that was very perplexing to the family by taunting them almost, by saying that there were things missing consistent with someone who walked away, and then refusing to divulge what such missing items were. So the family was completely at loggerheads with the UVA police department, who had never handled a homicide or such a missing persons case before. And there were questions about whether the campus cops were really the appropriate agency to be investigating such a thing. But when you and I got involved in the late 1990s, there were some interesting glimmers of Pat's life in Charlottesville, but they were things that you turned up that the police had not turned up, because you interviewed neighbors of Pat and you interviewed almost every student who had contact with Pat, and you realized that the UVA police had not even contacted his landlady, who was kind of a mother hen of sorts, who had once chastised Pat when he went away for the weekend without telling her. And so you found these gaping holes in the investigation, and then you kind of put on your detective cap. And I remember when you ran ads in a Washington, D.C. Newspaper trying to find out if people knew things about what was going on in Charlottesville at the time. And your research was very impressive, because you tracked down all these loose threads. But as it turned out, what we found here in the year 2013 flipped everything 180 degrees.
Yes, and what we found out in the year 2013 actually began in October 2012. A volunteer from the Doe Network, as in John Doe, which is hooked into a national federal database for missing and unidentified persons, contacted me. She emailed me. She had heard of Pat's case and seen my online coverage on the 25th anniversary for The Hook. When Hawes was the editor, I had done 25th anniversary coverage and set up a website, which is patcollinscase.com. And she had tried several times to get the UVA police to help her contact the family and get familial DNA into that big system. They had never responded, even though they would give lip service to wanting to do anything they could, you know, to help the family find Pat's remains. So she finally emailed me a little over a year ago, and I said, oh, I'll be happy to, you know, forwarded her message on to Pat's brother, Michael, in California. Well, then Michael contacted UVA police, and with San Jose police, they got the DNA from him and his mother, entered into the national database, and on August 10th, which would have been Pat's 54th birthday, they got a hit. What was so shocking was where the body they got hit on had been found, or I should say, the skeletal remains. So I'm going to turn this back over to Hawes now to talk more about where those remains were found and when they had been found.
Yeah, a very interesting twist. Unbeknownst to any of us down here in Charlottesville, a mere 2 years after Pat disappeared, a trio of hikers walking through a scenic hillside overlooking the little upstate New York town of Port Henry came upon the skeleton clad in deteriorating winter weight clothing and lying atop a rock outcropping with a panoramic view of the upstate New York countryside, including the giant waterway we know as Lake Champlain. So, for 27 years, the skeleton, or 25 years, the skeleton remained in a storage locker in an evidence room in upstate New York. At the time the bones were found, the local newspaper, quoting a local law enforcement, figured that the person must have been a hitchhiker and from out of the area, because there was no report of a missing person in New York. There was no vehicle found nearby. But the winter weight clothing was an interesting clue, and there was something else at the scene that was very perplexing, and that was a pair of syringes.
Now, a quick question. Again, our guest, Paul Spencer, Barbara Norden, as we talk about the case of Patrick Collins, a person who was missing for 25, is that what?
27 years.
That is, I don't know, I just find that to be, he worked in the hospital, so, but Barbara, you had belief, firm belief that he had, there were all sorts of murder issues.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, Barbara, I'm so sorry, your microphone is all weird. I'm gonna swap them out in just a second. So
you can borrow mine.
Yeah. Actually, you know what, Barbara, I'm going to add. Brandon, come in here and give me a quick hand. We're going to move Barbara over to this other microphone here.
We're good at sharing. We're done.
All right. So you've got this issue with a gentleman who was believed to be murdered and missing. And you do this study for
17
almost two
years.
Decades for you.
17 years. This was the central passion of my life, telling this story. I had discovered from the neighbor that apparently Pat had been being stalked, it looked to me like, by another man, who I suspect he probably met in the infamous locker room of the 1980s of Mem Jim, which was just over the top. For even gay men often didn't want to go there because it was so aggressive. I suspect that Pat may have been so needy emotionally, which we have evidence of, and we'll be talking about that in a series of letters he had written to a woman the year before in when he was still in California and she was in Florida. I suspect that being stalked, not doing anywhere near as well as he had hoped to be doing, I think, in his graduate program. He was only 10 weeks into it. The one grade he'd gotten was a C+. And I think that his family history was one of extreme family violence. I think that he wanted so badly to think that this would be his fresh start and his life was really finally going to take off at 27. And instead, I think everything crashed for him.
Yeah, can I interrupt?
Please do.
Barbara, when Barbara did one of her stories, her big stories for me when I was editing Seville back in 1997, she obtained a huge trove of correspondence between Pat in a very lovelorn state amid the time that his heart was getting broken by a woman who enjoyed his company but thought of him, one gathers from the letters, as an interesting plaything, but not as he considered her, which was as a soulmate. And when she writes him the Dear John letter explaining that not only are they not really an item, but that she has had this other boyfriend the whole while and she's moving to Florida with him, he's crushed. And Barbara found in these letters, he would pepper her with a letter a day, sometimes 5 days in a row. And at first he's kind of in denial. It's like the stages of grief. And then he's bargaining and he's trying to tell her that he'd be ready to jump to Florida on a moment's notice if she ever tires of this other guy. And then he says, of course we can be friends. And he's trying to move past, but amid all this, he sends her a couple of versions of a poem that he's written in his love-struck grief, and I think that this poem holds a key to unlocking the case. And I'll just read the last six lines of this poem. It's called "The Flight of the Snow Geese," and it's about a duo of snow geese, and that's a paired for life bird, a monogamous bird, which is important when you understand Pat's love and believing this woman to be his soulmate. And the birds migrate to cooler climes in the spring. And in his poem, one has been killed by the arrow of a hunter. "Northward they fly at winter's end, pleading and crying to find their friend. I need not look when I hear their cry, for I know what is in their hearts, and I sigh. The flight of the snow geese can be like dreams in vain, hoping to see that face when spring comes again.
So guess what? We overlooked all those years, or we didn't overlook it as much as everyone from the beginning scratched their head and said, well, I don't know. Pat had called the National Amtrak Reservations Line on the evening of March 20th, the spring equinox, and didn't make a reservation. So people said, well, you know, I guess he was thinking maybe eventually he'd go see a sister in Florida or something. But instead, based on finding out where those remains were, Hawes and also Courtney Stewart, the last editor of The Hook, who succeeded Hawes, were poring over the letters because Hawes wrote an excellent piece for a weekly in Albany after the discovery of the remains, which I urge listeners to, it's linked to on my website. And they were poring over the letters, and Courtney said, check out snow geese. And guess what? Snow geese congregate on Lake Champlain on their northward migration in the spring.
So, when did Pat disappear?
March 22nd. And Hawes dug in. He found the rail schedules. He found the ticket prices. And what we are now thinking is that probably early on the morning of Sunday, March 23rd, he took the train, conveniently located right there near Jordan Hall, got on the train and went up to New York, had a layover, and then went up to Port Henry, where they found him on the top of a very kind of inaccessible rocky bluff, was within walking distance. It was about 2 miles from the train station on the shores of Lake Champlain. So imagine how it felt to have gone on the radio and been in print in this small town for 17 years, insisting Pat Collins had been murdered. It was very, very hard for me to accept that I do believe that Pat killed himself and that Pat Collins set up the weird tableau in his apartment and especially Jordan Hall.
11:18 here on the Wake Up Call, talking with Barbara Norden and Hawes Spencer about the story of Patrick Collins, his missing case, presented as a murder, now discovered as a possible and probable suicide. Again, 11:18 here on the Wake Up Call, Barbara Norden and Hawes Spencer.
Our members are joined by the following underwriters in their support of WNRN.
L. Oppelman, serving Lynchburg for 122 years. In addition to loans, L. Oppelman deals in jewelry, musical instruments, rifles and handguns, game systems, TVs, cameras and tools, with new inventory arriving every day. L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street, downtown Lynchburg.
Just Curry. Just Curry is at 425 East Main Street on Charlottesville's downtown mall. Just Curry serves Indo-Caribbean curries with vegetarian options Monday through Saturday, now open for dinner on Friday. You can find Just Curry on Facebook.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Again, Barbara Norden, Hawes Spencer here with us here on WNRN, talking about the story of Patrick Collins, originally presented as a murder. Now with the latest information, skeletal remains discovered in 1988.
Uh-huh.
And then recently, through DNA testing, discovered that those are his remains up on a difficult to reach bluff above Lake Champlain. Barbara and Hawes, through Barbara, as you said, coming on the radio, presenting your stories, written stories through Seville and The Hook as a murder. I want to talk for a minute about some of the clues that were presented not just by you, but as you said, Patrick Collins' stepfather was a detective or a retired detective, mm-hmm. and there were plenty of other people. This isn't Barbara Norden standing alone saying, no, you're misinterpreting this. But some of the clues that many people took to be signs that it was a murder, and were they misinterpreted or just brought forth and they were meaningless? So you have the gentleman who was seen looking into his windows and smoking cigarettes, this sort of mystery stalker.
Yeah, that was to me the main element. The neighbor told me, and these two houses in Belmont on Montrose Avenue are practically on top of each other, that about six times she looked out her side window and could see this man around dinner time standing on their side of a chain link fence looking across at Pat's basement apartment, which would really disturb her, and she would usually just close the blinds and go to another part of the house. Didn't call the police because, you know, she would sometimes see Pat and him leave together, so she wasn't going to call the police on some weirdo who seemed to be a friend of this very nice young man. So I suspect I know he was in the gymnastics club working out at least once a week at Mem Gym. And as I said, that locker room was to the point where it got, you know, way over the line aggressive. And in fact, in a very notorious way, the then president of the Bar Association in 1993 was arrested for his public sexual behavior toward a man in the shower. So, I mean, this scene was bad. I suspect that Pat was so needy and possibly questioning his sexuality that he might have had some kind of sexual encounter with someone kind of a Mr. Goodbar type and been perhaps wishing that that hadn't happened and yet feeling like there was no one he could talk to about it. And that might have been something that really overwhelmed him.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to Hawes knows about this.
And I'll add one other little detail. In Barbara's interviews early on and in the letters that were sent to the police chiefs or the police chief of the UVA PD, friends and family were adamant. They said, there is no way on earth. I remember Barbara quoted the faculty advisor who said, this guy would have had to be the greatest actor on the planet to have, you know, walked away because he was so serious about his studies and he was such a dedicated student. And that was repeated, that sentiment was repeated by friends. They just couldn't fathom that Pat could have walked away. But I recall a couple of other very high profile Charlottesville based cases where people were certain of one thing and then forensic evidence showed them otherwise. One case was the case of Anastasia Manahan, as she was known after marrying a lifetime bachelor here in Charlottesville. She alleged that she was the youngest daughter of the Romanov family and that she had somehow survived the execution of the royal family when the Bolsheviks took over Russia. For years, her squalid lifestyle and bizarre behavior were overlooked by her friends and supporters who believed that she had miraculously survived this fusillade of machine gun fire in the basement of the royal house when the family was living in captivity. And it was only when DNA testing was done to establish her identity that we found out that not only was she not a Romanov, but she was most likely the Polish peasant woman who had been severely injured in a munitions plant accident around the time of World War II, and who had been and whose identity had been dismissed as, you know, not a very likely person to have who it would have been. But anyway, so that was a case where people said, "There's no way this isn't Anastasia." It's that dream of believing something that you know in your heart, but sometimes your heart is wrong and forensic evidence is right. Same thing with the Jefferson people who think Thomas Jefferson would never have cavorted with this slave. Well, guess what?
Duh.
The DNA says otherwise. And it's not, but it's in the Jefferson case, it's a little bit more complicated because it's not just the DNA. It's the DNA coupled with a lot of historical evidence on Jefferson's whereabouts at certain times. And there are still deniers who say, oh no, it can't be. But, you know, even the head of Monticello at the time, who had thought that it was unlikely that this was the case, put together a blue ribbon panel, and they weighed all the evidence when the DNA came out, and they came to the conclusion that the most likely explanation for why the DNA matched the descendants of the slave was Sally Hemings, was that Jefferson was the father of several children.
Well, let me jump up again. Our guest today, Barbara Norden, Hollis Spencer, two local journalists, as we talk about the case of Patrick Collins, someone who was missing for 20 years.
27.
27 years. Barbara writing about it for 17. And then just recently, his skeletal bones identified through DNA testing. And Hodge, you talk about what people believe in their heart versus what testing tells us. So let me jump to one of our other sort of missing person cases. We'll come back to Patrick Collins because there's more to that. But Alicia Showalter Reynolds.
Yes.
A brief story behind that is the woman who was pulled over, believed to have been pulled over on Route 29 by someone, a gentleman in a truck, flashing lights to tell her that there was a problem with her car. It's believed that she got in the gentleman's truck who had promised to take her somewhere safe for help. And then she was found dead 9 weeks later. And many people believe in their hearts that Daryl David Rice is the person who did this. He was then convicted of another crime. He was brought to court for a double murder in the Shenandoah Park. And that case didn't go through, and many people say that it's because the DNA testing didn't match up. But many people believe in their hearts that he must have killed Alicia Showalter Reynolds, but there's never been any proof about that.
I always am at pains to explain about the DNA, so-called the DNA evidence in the murders of Julie Williams and Lolly Winans, Memorial Day 1996.
The double murder
the
in
double
the
murder,
park that I
right,
briefly mentioned.
Yes, right off the Skyline Drive. When these two women were wonderful people, they were at a somewhat inaccessible campsite, but actually very, very near the lodge at Skyline Lodge at Skyland. Yeah, the big lodge up there. They weren't all that far. They were off kind of a fire road, and it took some time for their bodies to be discovered. Well, most of a weekend, I guess. And at first, they were completely flummoxed. Now, it came out quickly that this was a lesbian couple. And that's what the media glommed onto. John Ashcroft can be blamed for how completely down the toilet this then went. He immediately announced that it was...
Who's John Ashcroft?
He was the then Attorney General of the U.S. He announced it was a hate crime, and therefore they were going to seek the death penalty. I'm sure the government attorneys were appalled because they were thinking probably by the time they arrested Daryl Rice that they'd be lucky to get maybe first-degree manslaughter charges based on what little evidence they really had to work with. But because he was up against a death penalty, he attracted a very high-powered group. I wasn't the Innocence, well, maybe the Innocence Project, who swept in and made Daryl's case their call to arms. And the thing about the DNA is, The government, and I know this because I worked on this case extensively with a lot of assistance from the National Park investigator, Tim Alley, who was just wonderful. What was going on was Lonley's ankles had been bound with, I think, long johns, with ligatures, you know, to bind her ankles. And they hypothesized that to tie them that tightly, the murderer had to really, like, pull them with his hands. And in Britain, the standards for DNA admissibility are much, much lower than the U.S. You can magnify, you know, a piece of DNA many more times and still have it admissible. And Britain, was using and admitting into court a test for dead skin cells. So they figured, okay, the guy had to yank those long johns to tie him that tight, so his skin cells would have gotten off on. And the FBI intervened and said, wait, you don't want to do this, because the DNA you pick up could be from the seamstress at the factory. Do not go down this road. Oh, no. We know what we're doing. So they sent him off for this DNA test, and sure enough, it came up with DNA that did not match Darryl Rice. Now, in a stunning break of any logical connection, Darryl's team was able to convince a judge, and well, the federal government just dropped the case. They said, we can't convince a jury. You could have DNA from a number of people on those pajamas or whatever they were that didn't match Darryl Rice's. I figure he probably had gloves on or something when he killed him. I firmly believe Darryl Rice killed those two women. But they had to drop the case. The fact that someone else's DNA was on something at the scene, I could have walked by before they got murdered. I could have said, oh, hi, let me pet your dog. Oh, can I have a swig from your canteen? And then gone on my merry way, and my DNA would have been there. That doesn't prove that Darryl didn't come 10 minutes later and murder him. So this, to me, makes me semi-crazy.
But there's, you know, back to what Hawes was referring to, which is the belief that people have that something, it happened this way, and then that it did not do so, makes for trouble both in identifying who's at fault at the time, and then with the case of Patrick Collins, requires you to, or everyone, not just you, but for all of us who were following the case, to flip our thoughts and beliefs into how this played out and who was involved.
My hat is off to Barbara on the Pat Collins case for keeping an open mind, because she was convinced that it was murder. But when the pieces of the new evidence were put together, it really took her, 24, 48 hours to come around. And I had a similar experience with one of Pat's good buddies from college, who, when informed about the letters and the syringes and the location of the body and the identification back in Charlottesville. And this was a guy who had written one of those letters that said there's no way Pat would have left his academics for 2 weeks or 2 months or any time. He said, yeah, you know, now that I know what I know, it does look like Pat killed himself. So we're never going to get a definitive answer on Pat Collins, but reasonable people can put together the evidence and make reasonable suggestions. The science is very strong. Barbara mentioned earlier the cold hit that occurred in August of this year. You know, that's technology that would not have occurred and that was not available to a prior generation. And it's really due to two people in particular who did their job. One was a New York State investigator who, when he was promoted up in New York to his current position, he started looking at cold cases, and he said, okay, what can I do? I guess I should get these bones identified. And so he ordered up DNA testing, and then he entered the results in a national database. And then the volunteer for the group that Barbara mentioned earlier, the Doe Network, as in John and Jane Doe, she was as I said, a volunteer living in Pennsylvania, and Virginia was her jurisdiction where she was helping out. And she said she read Barbara's article, and she told me, "I was haunted. I knew that if Pat were alive, he would have called his mom by now." And so she set about trying to identify the remains. And in to do so, she tried to contact UVA PD, and they didn't even bother to call her back. So that's why she got in touch with Barbara through contact information at the Hook website, calls Barbara and says, "How do I get in touch with the family?" Barbara puts her in touch with the family, and next thing you know, you're getting DNA testing, and next thing you know, you've got a cold hit.
And here's the outrage that continues 27 years later. UVA never wanted this case solved. So here's this woman earnestly saying, hey, every time some likely remains would be discovered somewhere, she would contact UVA police and say, this is a possibility. Don't you want to get familial DNA? Which they could have done at any time. And they would blow her off. Okay, so only when the family calls and says, well, listen, we hear that someone's trying to get our DNA. Of course we want to do that. Only then do they go along. Yet, when Hawes wrote his article for Metroland and called the person in charge of this case, Lieutenant Melissa Fielding, I hope she's listening, but I'm sure she's not, and said, you know, wanted to interview her. No. She would only respond to written questions. And Hawes understandably said no. So she sent him this statement making it sound like it had been UVA's idea to do that. He emailed back and said, oh, wait a minute. I know that the volunteer contacted Barbara Norton and that UVA had not responded to earlier efforts. And she never replied. The Daily Progress ran a puff piece for the UVA police when they finally covered this huge discovery. And she carefully worded it. She said, and I had talked to the reporter ahead of time. I said, if Melissa Fielding tries to tell you that UVA initiated the DNA, it's a lie. And we have evidence because we have the email from Carol Haber. I said, Hawes confronted her, and she had no response. What do? They call her up, and she says, very carefully worded, that UVA began talking to the family last winter about getting DNA in.
She should have said UVA reluctantly talked to the family.
Right. Only reluctantly.
When all the other avenues were pushing in that direction.
11:39 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Hawes Spencer, Barbara Norton, two local journalists. We're talking about the missing persons case of Patrick Collins, which, well, the skeletal remains have been found. Thanks for tuning in here to WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Stick with us.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
the Jefferson Theater, presenting Frank Turner and the Sleeping Souls with special guest the Smith Street Band and Cuckoo Kangaroo on Tuesday, November 19th. Tickets for English folk punk poet Frank Turner on November 19th are at jeffersontheater.com. Frank Turner and the Sleeping Souls on Tuesday at the Jefferson Theater.
The Stork Diaper Service, proudly delivering cotton diapers to the Charlottesville and Richmond areas. The Stork is a full-service NADS cloth diaper provider, making it easy to keep your baby comfortably swaddled in plush, soft cotton. For more information, it's thestork.biz or 434-233-0130.
Hi, I'm Jennifer from Helpline. Helpline is a 24/7 free, anonymous, and confidential telephone service serving the Charlottesville and University communities. Volunteers provide callers with a non-judgmental, empathetic ear for any issue that the caller wishes to discuss. Volunteers remain anonymous and are trained to listen to callers with issues ranging from relationship issues to sexual assault to suicide. Since volunteers are not professionals, they focus on referring long-term services in the community for callers. If you need someone to talk with, 434-295-8825. That's 434-295-TALK. Or visit us online at madisonhouse.org/helpline. I'm Jennifer, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection@WNRN.org. With your nonprofit event or organization's information, Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks so much. This is Rick Moore here on Sunday Morning's Wake-Up Call here on WNRN. Our guests, Hawes Spencer and Barbara Norton. So, Barbara, you've done the research for this story. You've been following it. You have your own website devoted to this, patrickcollinscase.com. There's pictures. There's you can listen to voicemail recordings, correct? You can read letters that have been written back and forth. You personally, Barbara Norton, have covered this case and written articles that are in both of our local weeklies at the time. The news comes out in August, I believe, that there's been a DNA match.
It came out in early September.
Of this year. And Hawes Spencer gets his article published with Metroland before you get an article published. Is there any sort of like battle of the journalists on who got their article done first?
No, we had talked about that, and that was the plan, that Hawes was going to take over coverage of the discovery.
Remind me why you let me write it, because Barbara actually got the scoop from the family that the DNA was ongoing.
That Patrick Collins had been found.
Yeah, and I said, wow, that's interesting. We got to write about this, and you generously let me write about it, and even though it was really your facts.
Well, no, I had some method to that madness. I wanted to actually have Hawes be the one writing it and talking about my role, because I felt it would give me more credibility, actually.
Because you had that change of heart.
Just because I think it's always kind of more credible when one reporter can turn and you know, talk objectively about another journalist's covering of a case. Sort of, I felt it gave it a little more weight somehow. Hawes and Courtney insist that I would have eventually made this connection with the Snogies. I don't know. I sure wouldn't have made it in the time they did. Hawes, I have been telling him ever since that he is brilliant. He is a brilliant detective. He dug so deep, so fast to come up with that. It was so elegantly done. Hawes was the one to do that round. I'm the one to write the book. The book is not just cut and dried true crime. The book is a real organic mix of kind of my intertwining my life with this story and some events from when I was a young woman that made me so loaded for bear when I saw an institution manhandle someone like Pat and his family. So the book is not just dry restatement of the facts. I do not feel at all threatened. I'm thrilled that Hawes has done what he's doing.
Now, Hawes, you tried to, my understanding is that you had this article, or whether it was completed or not, again, the website defined the current article, Metroland.com, is that correct?
Metroland.net,
Metroland.net. Now, that's a weekly up in the upstate New York area. You couldn't even get this local story that our local media had been following and writing and publishing about for 17 years. You couldn't get one of the local papers to print that.
I can't explain why I couldn't. I tried. I carried my hat in hand to The Progress, to Seville Weekly, to the Cavalier Daily, to the UVA Alumni Magazine, to the Richmond Times-Dispatch. I actually got a faster and more sympathetic note back from both the New Yorker, the New York Times, actually not both, but three places, and the Washington Post. I got much more cordial treatment from those three national organizations, each of which declined the story but gave compelling reasons why it didn't work for them. The New York Times said it was too far upstate. The Washington Post magazine said that they were just getting ready to do another recently solved crime in long form. And the New Yorker, by the time I reached out to them, I had already been published in the Albany paper. And they said, well, it's already been published, so, you know, we're not really that interested. But, yeah, I got shut out locally, and it was frustrating because there was so much local interest. This was a Charlottesville story. I think people really wanted to hear how it turned out. And so I'm glad that Seville eventually came around and asked Barbara to write something. And even though they sort of botched it, I'm glad the Progress wrote something. Something's probably better than nothing, even though they wrongly credited UVA with a role in solving the case.
And they only wrote that. I mean, it just shocks me that Hawes had sent them this very complete coverage of the case. The Progress at the time covered the story exhaustively. Back in 1986, if you lived here, you lived and breathed Pat Collins for the month of April. And again, then when the parents showed up in May, you lived that case. It was like everyone's like, what's going on with this weird mystery?
Right, it was the front page. The front page
mystery.
It was
the big story. And the Progress didn't even say, okay, well, we're not going to let a freelancer write about it, but we're certainly going to cover it. I finally, in frustration, called the fabulous Bob Gibson, who had been involved with the story at the time. I said, Bob, they're not even going to just assign a staff reporter to write about it. And he hung up the phone, and before I knew it, the reporter was calling me. Of course, unfortunately, she botched it. But thank you to Bob. They at least ran coverage of it. He must have called and said, look, you guys, you have a healthy readership who remembers this well. This is a missing UVA student whose remains have been identified.
Oh, Barbara, writing this story through the years, the case of the missing Pat Collins, again, Patrick CollinsCase.com, just to see an exhaustive...
No, Pat Collins.
Pat Collins. Case.com, an exhausting level of information that Barbara and the Hook have unearthed. Exhausting, that's right. It exhausts me to go through it.
No, it's compelling.
Compelling.
It's not exhausting.
Well,
no.
But when I'm... Is compelling make you tired and depressed at the end of it the way that exhausting does? So a compelling amount of information on this through the years. But there are bits and pieces in this article that sort of lead towards a push as to this person might be have some negative involvement, negative role playing, dirty deed involved in this. Have those people, any of them, come forward? And what comes to mind is there is the gentleman in Mem Gym in the sauna area. There's the, I believe it's two or three people on a ski trip.
Okay, let me,
Poconos. Have those people come back to you and this has come out and said anything?
Oh, they don't even know. Like the local lawyer who's retired now, who was so obnoxious and finally got arrested and booted out of Mem Gym for good. I'm sure he's seen the Progress, but the former fellow graduate students, no, I don't think this is spread through any kind of network. That was always a very troubling part. Valentine's Day weekend, 1986, about 5 weeks before Pat disappeared, he had gone up to the Poconos with two fellow graduate students and a postdoc from physiology. And the cabin was owned by the parents of one of the students, Jeff Weiss. Okay, so this was on the front page of the Progress when the news came out. They interviewed these guys, and one, Doug Creedon, was quoted on the front page of the Progress as, yeah, he had been on that trip. Okay, so we fast forward 10 years, and it's November 1996. I've just decided I was working in physiology. I hadn't known Pat, but I had, in 1992, I took a job, a support staff job in the department. So in 1996, Doug Creedon, who is finished and done a postdoc elsewhere, is coming back to interview for med school. And another professor said, hey, one of our staff is going to write about Pat Collins. Could she talk to you? And he said, oh, yeah. So the professor brought Doug down to my office, and I looked in his eye, and I said, Doug, you were one of the guys on the Poconos trip. And he looked me straight in the eye and said, it was so odd, I still remember it. In this real kind of dead voice, he said, no, Barbara, I wasn't. And I thought, well, okay, that's raw, kind of odd, but I thought, I guess the Progress got it wrong. I realized later that on taped interviews, he also emphasized to me that he had not been on that trip. And I had taken him at his word. I called John Ziska, the postdoc, tracked him down, and I said, oh, tell me your memories of this weekend. And he says, oh, you know, we were doing this and that. And Doug was, I said, wait a minute, Doug wasn't there. And he said, yes, he was. I remember him cross-country skiing in the moonlight in a cornfield. And I said, oh, interesting. So for some reason, and Doug admitted, I emailed him later and said, were you there or not? And he said, well, I was, but I don't remember much. I thought, and at the time, Barbara, Pat's mother, had said that those two guys, the two graduate students, not John Zisk, had seemed shifty-eyed and nervous and like they didn't want to talk to him. And I thought, did something happen there? There was just too much commotion around Pat and other men. And I'm not saying that and I want to emphasize here, I am not suggesting that anything happened that weekend. But I think it's natural to say, why would you lie about being there? There were too many weird red flags.
11:52 on the wake-up call, talking with Barbara Norden and Hawes Spencer about Pat Collins. You can read more at patcollinscase.com. You can find Hawes' recent article about the finding of the bones and sort of a, I don't know if wrap-up's the right word, but an updated story about this case at metroland.net. And Barbara has a recent article at Seville, at the Seville Weekly site. So, Barbara, one of the things that I found interesting is that in Hawes' article, the brother Michael, Pat Collins' brother Michael, still seems to say, at one point I read a quote that says that Michael still believes it was murder.
The family is adamant. Clarence, Pat's stepfather, who is a wonderful human being, called me up a couple of weeks ago, really surprised me because my relations with the family have gotten changed now that they know that I believe that Pat killed himself. And Clarence is the salt of the earth. This treatment by UVA really, I think, broke him. And I don't, he's in his 80s now, and I don't think emotionally, I don't think psychologically that family can bear to go there.
And I would like to add, one of the things that's jumped out to me about this case and some of the other high profile murder slash missing persons cases in Charlottesville, I'll tell you a little tale about a few of them. With Alicia Showalter Reynolds, do you remember what her dad said the day her remains were discovered in the backwoods crossroads of Lignum in Culpeper County?
Something about, he said, you know, it ends the thing by at least coming home or having closure or something.
It was even more graphic than that. He said, thank God for the vultures.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, because the vultures surrounding the body is what brought somebody there to find it.
And I've talked to him a few times over the years, and recently I talked to Jill Harrington, the mother of murdered Virginia Tech student Morgan Harrington, who said the hardest part was not when they found her body. It was that 101 days of not knowing. On the same note, the mother of Katie Worski has sat down numerous times with the man convicted of killing her daughter, Glenn Haslam Barker, and pleaded with him to please tell her where the body is. Now, he maintains his innocence, but he was convicted of second-degree murder even in the absence of a body. It was a very rare conviction without a body.
Well, in that case, they found the young girl, Katie Worski, 12 years old, I believe. They found her blood type on a pair of young girl's panties hidden in his
sock drawer. Yeah, that's right. So there was some strong circumstantial evidence tying him to that crime, and that's why the jury convicted. But with the Pat Collins case, the family, as Barbara pointed out, has been so through the ringer with UVA that I think of the quote that Michael said to me. Michael, Pat's brother, said, we feel like we've won the lottery. We're getting Pat's remains back, and now we need to just go back to grieving. See, for the families, it's not an intellectual exercise on figuring out who done it. For the families, it's a very emotional trauma of not knowing. And can you imagine with Jill Harrington, she had to go 101 days. You know, that's what, 3.5 months. This family of Pat Collins had to go 27 years of not knowing where their son went.
It must have been absolutely, I can't even imagine. And it would have been awful in any case, but if UVA had responded the way they should have, and from the first involved the family in a compassionate way, they said at one point, I have it in writing, oh, stop by Ivy Road before you leave town and we'll show you the case file. Well, when things got, and the Shannons didn't, but when they got home and they could see that UVA really was going to trash Pat's memory and, you know, say that he walked away on purpose, that items were missing, and that was just a blatant lie because nothing was missing, they filed a Freedom of Information Act request. And remember, UVA had always insisted from the first he'd walked away, no criminal activity. They denied it on the basis that it was a criminal investigation. And in all the years since, I would send them FOIA requests. The family would send requests. We all would get the same form letter back. It's an open criminal investigation. 27 years later, they, you know, so their role was to make it worse. They appealed to an FBI agent, Ed Sulzbach, the UVA police, the vice president in charge at the time, Ray Hawes, asked this agent who had very briefly come over and kind of profiled Pat, which is ridiculous. Well, in hindsight, probably wasn't. But anyway, to give his evaluation of the police department's behavior. And he wrote this suck-up letter about how, oh, professionalism was the word from beginning to end. You can be proud. He admitted to me in 1996 he didn't know that they really hadn't investigated. They hadn't talked to neighbors. He was appalled to find that out. And then when I did the 2011 piece for the 25th anniversary, he further admitted to me that he had written that letter, in his words, to take the heat off the UVA police because the family would not stop complaining. UVA, from start to finish, just their behavior was just criminal. It was egregious. So they made this family suffer even more than they ever would have otherwise.
Just a minute or so left on WNRN Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Our guests, Hawes Spencer and Barbara Norden, as we talk about missing persons. Pat Collins case from 1986. Pause with an updated article, Metroland.net. Barbara, article on the Seville Weekly site. So, Barbara, what's next? I mean, again, we've talked several times during the hour about how your thoughts on the eventuality of the case have been changed. Not a murder, now a suicide. You mentioned even, you know, years ago when you were on the show talking about this, about writing a book. You're still going to write a book? And how
yes,
has the ending changed?
Very much so. Well, it makes me terribly sad. I think it's, I think the reader will have felt so close to Pat by the time we get to that. I imagine it's going to be just hard to integrate. I'm going to replicate Pat's journey. This will be the same calendar in 2014 as 1986. On Sunday, March 23rd, I'm going to take the early train up to Penn Station. Then I'm going to stay the night. Then I'm going to take the morning train, the Adirondack, up along the shores of Lake Champlain. And I'll be staying in Plattsburgh, but I'll rent a car and go down to Port Henry. One of the New York State Police will probably take me up to that bluff. I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to get up there. It sounds like it's not a walk in the park, but I really want to be there. I want to be there where Pat was at the very end. For 17 years now, I have felt very, very intimately tied to this man. I have held objects that he owns. I've listened to his voice. And I just want to be able to be in the place he was when he left this world. That'll be some closure for me.
All right. And we'll of course, let everybody know when the book comes out. Barbara Norden, Hawes Spencer, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Again, Metroland.net or the Steveville Weekly site for Hawes and Barbara's latest works. Thank you so much, everybody. Next week, extraterrestrials with one of the UVA astronomy professors.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.